Blog Talk Radio.
That is my cue, everyone. You are listening to This Week in Health Innovation on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Welcome, everyone. I'm Greg Masters, the creator, producer, and co-host of the show. Also in the virtual studio is my colleague and co-host, Dr. Phil Marshall, co-founder and chief product officer of Conversa Health, an innovative patient engagement and digital health checkup company. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you again, Greg.
Absolutely. So glad you could make it. And This Week in Health Innovation is brought to you by the Health Innovation Media, where we monitor the innovation impulse from idea to business model. And today we continue our singular focus on the innovation economy with a visionary and thought leader in this emerging space, and that is John Nosta. John is a thinker entrenched in the world of science, medicine, and innovation. He's the founder of Nosta Lab, an amorphous, self-organizing neural network dedicated to the advancement of digital health. Unwilling to accept the status quo, he's a contrarian. We've been hearing a little bit about that before we went on air. With a focus on the future of health and wellness, a leading voice in the convergence of technology and health, Nosta helps define, dissect, and deliberate global trends in digital health. He's also the number one CRED-ranked social media influencer in health and in the top 10 of both the Pharma 100 and HIT 100 lists and a Google Glass Explorer. John also pens Health Critical for Forbes, a top global blog on health and technology with over 1.5 million page views in the last year. He's made appearances on Bloomberg Surveillance as a contributor and guest host. John has an established reputation as a vocal advocate for strategic thinking and creativity. He's built his career on the science of advertising, a process where strategy and creativity work together for superior marketing. He's also been recognized for his ability to translate difficult medical and scientific concepts into material that can be more easily communicated to patients, clinicians, and scientists. And there's more, but with that truncated introduction to John, I'm going to turn it over to you, Phil. Help us get to know this man.
Oh, absolutely. And John, it's a great pleasure to have you. Welcome to the show.
No, thank you very much. Greg and Phil, you guys are resident voices in this community, so it's a privilege to be here. I was going to suggest that we stop the interview now. With that introduction, I don't think I can do any better.
Well, we do have, as we're always prepared with a lot of background music, just in case we have a technical glitch, we can certainly go to that, but I think this audience would be thrilled to hear some of your thoughts on the topics of the day, and there are many.
Sure.
You know, as I look back over your work and your areas of focus, I always keep a sheet here of topics and questions with me that I've written down, and I had to divide it into so many categories I can barely read it. Provider, payer, pharmacy, consumers, digital health, you know, even pharmacogenomics, for God's sake.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'd like to do, first of all, is just sort of set a framework. You've looked at a lot of these issues. You have been at times a skeptical eye on them, at times a cheerleader. And you've challenged us to think beyond what we're able to see today, beyond, for example, the topic of wearables to the topic of dermals and consumables, to think about things like IBM Watson and what they might be able to provide to us. So as you look out over the landscape of digital health in each of these areas, the first question I have for you is, among each of the different players, the major players here we're talking providers, payers, pharmaceuticals, consumers, where do you feel the greatest disruption is going to come from over the next few years?
Wow. That's a very interesting question, because the disruption as a function of technological innovation certainly can be in clinical practice. The advancement of the electronic medical record, the integration of technology into care. So I think you may see those disruptive changes occur in the context of care. But then you've got to look at good old pharma, who is sitting on the sidelines trying to reinvent themselves a little bit. So that may become more disruptive for them just because of the nature of change. They may be caught with their proverbial pants down in a way. Well, clinicians might be disrupted, but I think they're going to be disrupted in a way that will enhance care, that will enhance their practice. It'll change it, inevitably. So that's very interesting. I think disruption will impact the clinical practice, number one, which will be a good disruption. I think that life sciences and pharma will be disrupted in a way that will change their game from things as fundamental as the way the rep sells or interfaces with a physician. And then thirdly, I think patients' lives will be disrupted in a way where they will become empowered, and I think that's also a positive disruption. So I think the key here is to frame up disruption in the context of, is it good or is it bad? If someone gives me $1 million, they're going to disrupt my life quite a bit, but it's a pretty good disruption. So I'll take a breath there.
All right. No, that's a great and a great start, and I'd like to hone in right on your number one area of disruption, and that is the physician, the provider, the health system, the multi-specialty clinic, that arena in which so much of our care is delivered, and the load of costs is spent. And so here recently you talked a little bit about IBM Watson, and I'd like for you to, whether it's using IBM Watson as an example or other examples, I'd like for you to help us better understand from your point of view what the role of the physician will be. It's been speculated that we'll be 50,000 primary care physicians short by 2025 because of new people entering the system and a lack of ramp-up of people going to medical school. And so as we try to accommodate this enormous mass of people coming into the system, it seems ripe for disruption. Help us understand what you're seeing on the horizon, what's going to be the role of the physician.
You know, I think that the interesting point is when we look at the evolution of medical care and the role of the physician, that's going to change a la things like IBM Watson. We'll get to that shortly. But I think you're going to see the empowerment of the allied health professional in a variety of ways, too. So the answer isn't as simple as just saying we're going to have a robot, and the robot's going to become my doctor, and that doctor's going to be powered by IBM Watson. I think that the pharmacist will play an emerging role, the nurse practitioner. The challenge is oftentimes the requirements put upon these people, the clinical responsibilities will be pushed higher and higher, but it'll get outside their level of competence. So that, to me, is a very interesting emerging trend. Number one, the shift of care away from the physician. That's going to be interesting because it's going to cause a bit of a problem with respect to that nurse practitioner. Phil, you know as well as anybody, you get a PA to come see a patient who's got, let's say, a little bit of chest pain because of a chronic cough. You know, is that an MI? Is that costal chondritis? It's a very challenging scenario. So that's number one. That's going to be very, very interesting. And that's an opportunity for a lot of solutions because what that leads to is the second point. And I don't think the physician is going to be replaced categorically, even though I love to say that because it gets people so upset and angry and it provokes a dialogue. So the replacement of the physician is probably going to be more like augmenting the physician's knowledge base of care. Let's take a look at the EKG. Everybody gets an EKG. That EKG is read by a computer. It's not definitively read by a computer, but when the printout comes out, it has the PR interval, the QRS, the axis, ischemic changes, any kind of underlying abnormality. A physician looks at that, and that knowledge is augmented by a computer. So I think in the simplest of terms, you already see this in place. People just don't recognize it. Now, let's talk about my friend IBM Watson, because I actually use the word my friend IBM Watson, because it's not just a computer. It's a relationship. And that relationship is going to be part of driving the engagement. It's not just the knowledge base I have with my doctor. It's the relationship I have with my doctor that helps augment care. So I think it's amazing that what IBM did – to validate their technology is go on television on Jeopardy with Ken Jennings. What an interesting tactic to validate the intellectual acumen of a machine. A lot of people in pharma, if they were asked to do this, they would immediately seek out a multi-million-dollar clinical study or linguistic analysis at Stanford. But IBM Watson zigged what everyone else would traditionally zag and created this television engagement. So I think that the physician knowledge base will be augmented. Here's an example. IBM processes 3 million pages of information in 2 seconds, or 2 million pages in 3 seconds. I always get it wrong. That's amazing. I don't think it's any longer a game of who's smarter. IBM wins by default. It's ultimately the integration of that knowledge to augment clinical care in a way that is user-friendly, that it can be served up either on Google Glass as a drug-drug interaction or an algorithm for more sophisticated cancer therapy or something that pops up in the chart. So that's kind of like the 30,000-foot view.
So interesting. When you think about Watson's ability to digest, analyze, mm-hmm. and produce an answer so quickly, then the question becomes, how does it get that information? And then how is the information that it's going to get going to be used? Is it going to continue to rely on that human touch of the physician to relay information, to support decision-making? You know, there's this notion recently that we've been reading about called flip the clinic, which is change the clinic from a place where you're simply gathering data to where you're actually interpreting the data and helping guide decisions. And so I'm wondering two questions. What about that data collection, and how can it get the kind of data that's going to be most useful to make decisions? And then when that information arrives, is it still going to be the physician that helps the patient navigate it?
Can I can answer that question in one word, yes. Now let's take a step back. If I ask you a question about a particular medical scenario, you can provide a lot of information, a lot of relevant information that is not directly related to the patient. In other words, if I ask you what happens when you press on someone's abdomen at McBurney's Point, without even touching, seeing, or hearing about that patient, you know that that's a potential appendicitis. And that's the same thing with Watson. Watson is full of information that doesn't require direct engagement. If I know that I have high cholesterol and I happen to have a high C-reactive protein and I have an X or Y there, Watson can pull together a certain therapeutic algorithm to help point care in one direction. Now, the flip side to that is when you have the engagement of the physician input of the electronic medical record, that just takes things to the next level. So I don't think it's one or the other. I think that you'll see a transition where the fundamental database of information is available to make a differential diagnosis. That will be, again, we're using the word augmented about 10 times so far, will be augmented by the electronic medical record, by something called natural language, which is a really cool thing we should spend time talking about. You know, if I say I feel funky, that could mean that I want to dance or that I'm sick. And it's the ability to understand, translate, and utilize natural language that could be a big advantage for Watson, because now you'll be able to have real-time live input based upon human conversation as opposed to the zeros and ones of coded data.
This is a perfect segue. Natural language, interfacing with the real world and drawing meaning from it. So there is an 800-pound gorilla in natural language processing sitting right down in the Bay Area called Google. Now, my friend Adam Bosworth's effort at Google and Google Health initially with the personal health record was not successful, but boy, you can sure imagine with their ability to process natural language and tie things together so smartly that they may be an emerging power in this particular arena. Any insights into the role that they might play?
The first Google Health was an interesting first step. And as I understand it, and I talked to Ronnie Zeger, who led that charge, it became more of a HIPAA compliance issue, as so many issues are around managing health data. You know, Google Health was more of an electronic medical record type scenario. So I think that Google will probably move forward in this direction for a variety of reasons. Number one, let's look at what's going on with Google. Google Calico is a very interesting dynamic. The CEO from Genentech has come over, and the founder, rather. I think that what you're finding is a real movement into this quote-unquote longevity space. So we'll probably find some interesting steps along the way in terms of what Google is doing. Still kind of a little bit secretive, which I think is interesting. But the use of
and
natural
Google
language.
Glass.
Well, Google Glass, but also
Google
natural
Glass
language.
Glass is another example. Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, for example, flu tracker. There's been a lot of talk about how that kind of failed, how epidemiological analyses based upon word choice and things like Twitter didn't quite work. So there have been a little bit of a stumble there. There are other ways of moving that forward, but I think you're going to see a lot of very, very interesting areas along the lines of human longevity.
Interesting. Well, you know, on the topic of Google Glass, you know, that's an interesting effort by Google that does, in fact, interface with the real world and then try to make some sense of it. And and there's a company down in the Bay Area using that technology in the doctor's practice. It's called Augmetics. And that company is using Google Glass to collect the visit by video with the patient to get the natural language out of that visit in order to place that structured data into the electronic health record and then present at the point of care right up into the eyesight of the physician all of those data points that they might find helpful in helping that patient navigate their health. The role of Google Glass in healthcare, thoughts about how it could help support that care scenario?
Well, Google Glass is an experiment, and I think we have to remember that first and foremost. It's still a beta, yet it's been received with such public outcry, both good and bad, that it's been forced under the microscope at a point when it's really not ready. So that's my one point. I've been a Google Glass Explorer for, it seems like, about a year now, and there's still a lot of bugs. But there are certain issues that I think that emerge that have potential clinical application. The first is something that I call medicine at a distance. We're looking at the ability of moving care from an institution, from a clinical setting to the field. So, for example, if you have a car accident today, you go to the hospital. Tomorrow, the hospital will come to you. And that's what I mean by medicine at a distance. So if you're in the field putting in a chest tube and you have Google Glass, you can have a more trained physician or an attending physician help guide you through the process and actually live the experience while you still have hands-free heads-up display. So those sort of scenarios, I think, are very, very important. In the impoverished world where you have no infrastructure, you still have a cell phone. And cell phones are the conduit through which Google Glass comes to life. So I can have a physical exam. I can work with an intern or a resident or a young physician and have someone from the best institution in the world interfacing with them directly. So that's the medicine at a distance possibility with Google Glass, which I think is important. The other is this idea of apps. Imagine your smartphone with no apps. That's a little bit the way Google Glass is now. The new development of technology and applications will create a variety of things, from engagement with the patient to natural language selection and recording to anatomical overlays to pop-up displays in the glasses that interface with an EMR and show, let's say, an allergy or drug reaction. There was a physician in Boston who recently claimed to have, quote-unquote, saved a life because I don't know if it was a drug interaction or something that popped up on his Google Glass display with respect to a person receiving a medication. So there's a lot of interesting things, but I challenge everyone to almost take one step back and give Google Glass a little bit of a break because it's still a beta, yet we're looking for clinical triumphs right now, and I don't think they're going to happen.
One of the things that you're fond of speaking about is the lessons that we can learn from failure. Now, if Google Glass fails, there would be a lot that would be learned from it. If it succeeds, there will be a lot that will be learned from it. We talked about Google Health and the initial PHR effort and how there was a lot learned from that. What are some of the failures that you've observed recently that you think instruct us most about the future of digital health?
Well, I think that digital health is full of failures, some that are perhaps not as apparent, others that are quite apparent. Let's take a look at the push to market, and the issue just happened recently with Scanadu and their device Scout. They raised, I don't know if it was 5 times or 10 times the amount of money that they initially had tried to do on Indiegogo, and they moved to market very quickly, and there were some technological flaws. They couldn't get the device to work, so that delivery was put on hold. Those are some of the stumbles. Looking at wearables just in general, I think wearables, to a certain degree, are both a tremendous success and a miserable failure. I think most people that have a Nike Fuel or a Fitbit or other devices have those devices firmly placed on their shelf in their bedroom, and it's lost its charge and they're not using it. So I think the whole issue of compliance is a real emerging failure with digital health because people haven't made emotional connections to these devices. So here's the takeaway from that, which I think is really interesting. Digital health and these devices and these trackers and all sorts of things were in part developed to help us take our medicines. And yet these devices seem to be no more compliant than the very pill they're helping us be reminded to take. So that's the nature of innovation. Innovation is all about 2 steps forward, 1 step back. And unfortunately, the 1 step back tends to be more newsworthy than the 2 steps forward. So failures from a VC perspective, where they're not only looking for the success in the context of a therapeutic outcome, but they're looking for the success as an exit strategy, as a cash-out strategy. So I think that it's inherent in something moving this quickly that we're going to have failures. I think we should celebrate failure. I think that in certain instances, people should be rewarded for failures because that's part of the creative process.
It's interesting that we talk about wearables like Nike's Fuel Band because they've recently announced the pulling back on that mm-hmm. initiative. And yet you look at Fitbit, and, you know, I have an acquaintance that works there that gave me an incredible stat, and that is that the vast majority, an almost unbelievably high percentage, of their devices that have ever been sold continue on a weekly basis to contribute data into their system, which is really quite remarkable. And if that's true, if that holds true, that means some are used in a regular and ongoing way while others do not. Now, we know that Fitbit originally and most of those devices still just clip on as a pedometer, really. And mm-hmm. so it's a very, very uninvasive kind of thing. And you've been fond of saying that we really need to get down to no burden whatsoever, down to nothing, mm-hmm. as you've called it, in not having to wear anything, where you can just have dermals or you can have consumables. As we look ahead, do you feel that all of these devices, you know, the Jawbones, the Fitbits, et cetera, are going to inevitably have to dissolve away, and we have completely, basically zero burden on the consumer in order to get data from them that's going to be useful?
You know, I think that's an aspirational goal, that technology evaporates, that we don't know that we're actually using it. There'll always be the room for the wearable monitor. There'll always be room for devices. But as I track this, both from the bottom up and the top down, I see a lot of interesting trends. The use of your bathroom mirror as a way of scanning your pulse in the morning is a much less intrusive way of looking at heart rate. Things like your toothbrush to scan for cavities, things that are integrated into our daily life. For example, sensors don't have to clip on your belt. Sensors can be part of an undershirt that you wear every day. It's that kind of level of advancement that just allows these things to be absorbed into our lives. For example, an example that I use often is Medtronic partnering with Ford, making a sensor for blood glucose that works in the steering wheel of your car. So here's an opportunity where a technology company, a device company like Medtronic, partners with a company like Ford and changes the way we look at glucose monitoring. Of course, they're watching out for people who are either hypo or hypoglycemic while driving. So it's that kind of incorporation into life that no longer makes it an option. It makes it just an inevitable reality. That's the nature of the world we live in. The quantified self is not a choice. The quantified self is the reality in which we live. Very much like a FICO score. You may not want to have a FICO score, but you got one. And it's the same thing with the quantified self. It's just part and parcel of being human in a technological world.
All right. Well, that's really brought us mm-hmm. around a variety of different topics. So we've talked about the mm-hmm. physician. We've talked about wearables and the patient. We've talked about artificial intelligence, if you will, a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that brings me around to what's happening at NASTA Labs. And mm-hmm. and some of the work that you're doing there, you've described it as self-organizing, which makes me think self-aware, which then makes me think of Skynet. And so let me just be the first to say that if you are a self-organizing and self-aware system like Skynet, I am your friend, and you can trust me to be a partner. But having said that, you know, what are your big plans? What are some of the things that you're seeing on the horizon that interest you most of the lab?
Sure. Well, when we talk about self-organizing, this amorphous think tank, what I'm trying to get at there is that because technology is changing, because sometimes we have to talk about Ford Motor Company and a steering wheel, other times we have to talk about pulse oximetry, yet other times we have to talk about logo design and creativity, the ability to have a group of 5, 10, 50, or 100 people to solve all your problems as full-time staff, and it doesn't make any sense. So what NASTA Lab does is creates a network of individuals that can be dialed up or dialed down as needed. The complexities of problems in digital health are broad and vast, and it's my challenge to create the best and the brightest at any given moment. Basically, it's task, and that's what we're driving at. The other side of the equation is simply put, innovation is only empowered by effective communication. So as we talked earlier, before we went on air, the Higgs boson is called the God's particle, a fundamental discovery in physics that is very, very important. Lots of people talk about it, but no one understands it. So if you can't empower innovation through effective communication, what good is it? And I find that in digital health, people spend a lot of time on the device, a lot of time on miniaturization, a lot of time on, well, maybe their website, which is usually a picture of their device anyway. But they don't spend fundamental thinking about the best way to communicate their position to consumers, to customers. And that's very important because if there's no connection, that inevitably they'll fail, not as a function of innovation, but as a function of communication. And that's a real, real important differentiation for me. And finally, what we try to do at NASTA Lab is have informed resources. And it's very difficult to find people who understand the science of cardiology, of what ST segment elevation is, and then understand the technology of sensors, and then understand the nuances of strategic thinking and creativity. So we try to build a network where those needs are served, and our clients create products that are destined for greatness and not destined for failure on the basis of poor communication.
I see. So that's helpful. So really, really almost a market strategy and communication firm that helps you to understand how best to reach your target audience. And it gets into such an interesting area of saying the right thing to the right person at the right time, especially if we're talking about between physicians and their patients, for example, and motivating behavior. And so is that particular area, this sort of holy grail of behavior change and motivating positive behavior change in patients, one of your areas of focus?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's interesting because a lot of people go right to the patient. I've spoken with CEOs of a lot of large companies as well as some small startups, and they've all adopted this phrase of democratization of health, that the patient will become the final arbiter of care and drive activity. I don't accept that at face value. I think it's a much more complicated dynamic because I think that a clinician has tremendous power. There are two powerful people in our lives. There are, well, actually more than that, but there are our parents who blueprint the kind of behavior and decisions we make. And then there's the physician, who is a surrogate parent in many ways. So advocacy of a healthcare provider can help drive behavior. And so it's a more complex dynamic. The problem is when you start dissecting it and get these different audiences. For example, if I'm selling a device like Kinza, which is a wonderful electronic thermometer, pushes the data up to the cloud that creates a temperature-based heat map of a disease prevalence. That's a really, really cool thing. I think a lot of moms would like to see that. Go online and take a look
Absolutely.
At a heat map, a weather map of who has a fever in their community. And either they keep their
it's
kid
an
home,
exciting,
make
it's
sure,
an,
right? It, it's a simple.
Yeah, absolutely. It's
however,
an exciting
if
development.
My doctor says it doesn't work, would you use it? If the pediatrician is not an advocate behind it, would you use it? An electronic thermometer.
It's a great point, and we'll go ahead and wrap it up with that idea, and that is that it's not just the message, but it's also who it comes from, and so I will just have to say, IBM Watson,
terrific.
Take that.
Wonderful.
John, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
What a great
Greg, Phil, always a pleasure. And thank you for the great job you're doing getting the word out.
Very good.
And that'll have to be the last word. What a fabulous conversation. You guys, hate to bring this one to a close, but you've been listening to This Week in Health Innovation, and we've been speaking with John Nosta of Nosta Lab, interviewed masterfully by my colleague, Dr. Phil Marshall. We do this weekly on This Week in Health Innovation. Join us next week for another edition, and we'll talk to you then. Greg Master saying bye now.